Украинское войско терпит крах.
Украинская армия обстреливает мирных жителей. Это не что иное, как
до сих пор под жесточайшими обстрелами украинских
сил. Что это бандеровцы переодетые.
Стаханов. Это сейчас самые напряженные точки. В ДНР принято решение.
Секунду будут судить. Безусловно, будут судить. Но я призывал украинцев не подавляться.
Сюда ударили или мины, или снаряды.
Самое жуткое.
Sometimes disinformation is more than just disinformation. Sometimes propaganda is more than just propaganda. Sometimes lies are more than lies. Sometimes, when the disinformation, propaganda, and lies are accompanied by fast-moving montages of disturbing images and an ominous soundtrack, something more nefarious is going on. A recent report by BBC Monitoring suggested that Russian state TV's coverage of the conflict in Ukraine does not simply contain one-sided and often misleading propaganda. It also appears to employ techniques of psychological conditioning designed to excite extreme emotions of aggression and hatred in the viewer. And it appears to be working. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the recently published book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And also joining us via Skype, also from London, from a cafe in London, as I understand, is journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell in and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome back, Ben. Good to see you.
Hello.
So, Peter, let's start with you. I mean, in your book, you described the way news was presented on Russian television as being like a reality TV show. But after reading the BBC report, it looks a lot more like a reality horror movie, no?
Yeah, I mean, in the book, I actually compare the way Kremlin uses media to the way a cult indoctrinates people. So there's several stages there, which are just the way a cult works. So first comes the breakdown of critical thinking, which happens en masse on Russian TV. I mean, to a great extent, through the use of conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories as a form of discourse is, you know, a non-debatable space where you can't debate with it because it uses false logic, false assurances, bizarre constructions. I mean, Dmitry Kiselyov is a great example of that, you know, with his favorite catchphrase is «совпадение», «не думаю», «a coincidence», «I don't think so». So this is the classic sort of, you know, classic bit of linguistic manipulation he'll take, you know, a TV show showing about sex education in Sweden and use that to show that pedophiles have taken over Europe and trying to attack Russia. It's that classical thing, you know, Obama's ratings are down. He's trying to destroy Russia. You know, it's this classic thing they do, which destroys any possibility of debate because it's illogical and implants illogical thinking. And then they start working on sort of the emotions of the audience. So they make the Russian audience relive historical traumas, so the 1990s, you know, but not in a healthy kind of like therapeutic way, but in a really sort of dark way, like remember the 1990s, we were abused by everyone, did you feel bad then? Which is a classic thing that cults do, they'll make you relive sort of like when you were abused as a child or something. And then instead of curing it, they then kind of say, but we can cure that. And then in comes Putin, I'll save you. By the time the information arrives, which is absurd, can be absurd, like, you know, fascists are taking over Kiev, that just lands on an audience that's completely emotionally already ready to receive anything, any kind of information. So it's very much exactly the same way that a cult works. And the heads of Russian TV are very into studying cults, studying NLP. They're very interested in these methodologies, and they sort of apply them somewhat haphazardly, but when used in a mass kind of way, very effectively.
Now, when you in the past had worked in Russian TV, did you see any hint that this kind of thing was in the offing? I mean, a lot of these techniques were, I mean, a lot of these people cut their teeth in the 90s, and now they've really brought this stuff to fruition. Yeah. Now, did you run into anything like this in your time in Russian media?
Yeah, continually. They've been using it for around 15 years. The thing is that they're now using it in foreign policy. As in, like, we can see it being enacted upon another state, Well, they're using it internally forever. I mean, they used it during Georgia. And the whole of Russian TV is based like that. This is something they've been moving towards. I mean, not strategically, they've kind of been stumbling towards it as they look for new ways to manipulate people over a period of 15 years. And look at something like NTV, you know, which is basically non-stop. NTV is one of the biggest channels in Russia. Mm-hmm. It does show what a great country Russia is, the way the Soviet propaganda was. It shows how awful Russia is, full of murder. And, you know, it's meant to make them feel really, really scared, full of gangsters and murderers and terrorists. But Putin will save you. Mm-hmm. And this for 15 years. A lot of the time they're using it for commercial purposes, you know, to sort of like big up their channels and make them more successful. But there's always been a political kind of use as well.
Ben, what are your thoughts? I mean, you looked at the BBC monitoring report. What was your reaction to this? Because my first reaction was, this is beyond propaganda. It's not your run-of-the-mill propaganda. It's getting into programming and conditioning and brainwashing. What were your thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's beyond propaganda. I think historically that has been the nature of propaganda in extremely aggressive autocratic regimes across Europe. I don't really see a major difference from propaganda we saw 20 or 30 years ago in Turkey, or from propaganda from the 1930s across Europe, or from some of the worst moments of Soviet propaganda, or propaganda deployed today in China.
So you don't see anything different going on? Because when I was reading the BBC monitoring report, I got the sense that we're not just talking about disinformation, but in the way the music was used, in the way the montages of images they were trying to, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the second half, put people into a trance-like state. A lot of this is what jumped out at me was beyond propaganda and into something that's a little bit more sinister. But you didn't.
This is exactly what Nazi marches were about. That was the point of them, to gather people in one place, lots of music, lots of fire. The word trance is used very practically by psychologists. It's any moment where you switch off your critical thinking. So you watch a movie, you're in a state of trance. You read a book, you're in a state of trance. You listen to music, you're in a state of trance. It's not a creepy word. It doesn't mean like, you know, out of body levitation or something. Trance is a very practical term. The way it's used in hypnotherapy. So as is hypnosis, it's not like, you know, Shere Khan and Mowgli. It's actually a very, very easy technique to use. Magicians use it all the time.
Mm-hmm. It diminishes your critical capacities, though.
Well, no? That's the whole point. But yeah, that was exactly the point of the Nazi marches, you know, with their sort of the knights, you know, the marches, the fire and stuff like that. So I think maybe the problem is our use of the word propaganda, which has become meaningless. I was at a conference a couple of months ago, and this at Cambridge of all places, and this girl stood up and said, "What's the difference between Russia Today and a shampoo ad? You know, that's brainwashing as well." So I think the word propaganda has become sort of pointless in that it means too many things. So clearly there's disinformation, misinformation, and then there's psychological manipulation, mm-hmm. The use of hypnotic techniques. These are all come under the broad umbrella of propaganda. I think what's new about Russia is that it's sort of focused them and made them so powerful to such an extent. And also it's made them the weapon, because usually sort of the Nazis would put, you know, their troops in a state of trance and then sort of start a real war. Well, the Russians are actually using the information as the main weapon, often not with anything else. So that's what's new. The information is now the main thing. The propaganda is now the main thing.
Right. Now, in the past, Peter, and when we've discussed the role of Russian propaganda abroad, we've said it's not to convince, but to confuse, to muddle, to plant seeds of doubt. And in Russia, it was kind of to distract. But in a lecture last spring, Valery Soloveyev, a professor at MGMO, the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, suggested the role was also to program, to download ideological software into people's brains, so to speak. Professor Soloveyev's lecture was cited extensively by BBC Monitoring Report, and we'll dive into it a little bit deeper in the second half. But I wanted to get both of your reactions to his main premise. So let's listen to Professor Soloveyev now for a few seconds.
I've used the term manipulation many times. You may think that this is deception. It isn't. The most important thing is to understand that it isn't deception. This is because when the methods that I'm talking about are used to create a certain image of the world, they also create a kind of reality for us. If we perceive this reality as it is brought to us by television, then we act in accordance with that reality.
I think that last sentence is the key there. I mean, if we perceive this reality as it's brought to us by the television, then we act in accordance with that reality. This would explain a bit why so many Russians, for example, are prepared to go volunteer to fight in Ukraine, which to me looks like a pretty crazy thing to do. But yet people are willing to do it. And in interview after interview, we get that, you know, they saw what was going on in Ukraine on the television and they felt they had to go do something about it. I'd like to get both of your thoughts on that. I mean, have you come across, how much have you seen in your interactions with people in Russia, the people that are under the influence of this kind of a thing? Peter, Ben, whoever wants to jump in first is fine with me.
I just want to say that I noticed in Moscow, especially in the younger swathes of the elites, men who were taking particular, almost physical pleasure in the war, people who were taking a sort of sexual buzz from the satisfaction that Russia was winning, that Russia was conquering, that Ukrainian tanks had been scorched from the earth, that the nation was winning again. And I think that was new. I hadn't noticed that sort of frisson coming off Russian officials before. It's by no means the majority. It's probably a small minority of people, but that's certainly at play. I think there's a worrying midterm possibility that if you start feeding a population televised humiliation, bombing, tragedy, day after day after day, Russia's passive mentality would switch into a more aggressive one. And I'm intrigued as to whether or not next year, when the recession really starts to hit Russia, if the government will change the nature of this propaganda from presenting Russia as the victim and Eastern Ukraine as the innocent slaughtered by the Nazis into propaganda of aggression, that Russia needs to march and take forward, people need to participate in something.
So it's this is actually something I also wanted to get Peter's thoughts on this, because Peter, you used to say that they can't keep the system too hot. The system is built on passive acquiescence. But yet, yeah. What they're doing with this propaganda is they're dialing it up to 11, never mind 11. They're dialing it up to 12, 13, 14, and 15. Is this keeping it too hot for the system?
Well, this is what I mean. So the difference between, let's use the word propaganda now that we've semi-defined it. The difference between, let's say, what the Nazis did and what Putin generally does is that their aim is not classic agitational propaganda. So usually the aim of propaganda is to get people to get up and go to war. Here it's not. They want them to feel victimized, you know, horrified by the awful West and the awful Ukrainians who are killing all these innocent children. I mean, most of the propaganda in Donbass is dead kids, dead kids, dead kids being killed by right. Ukrainians, supported by Americans. It's very, we are the victim. It's very, we're the good guys. Look at these monsters. What are they doing? That's the main bit of it. So that and that, you know, there were adverts saying, and if you catch anyone saying we should go to war in Ukraine, you should know they're working for the CIA. America wants to drag us into its dirty war. Remember those ads when it got too hot? They're trying to dial it down. So they want people horrified but not moving from their couch. You know, they want them plastered there. It's what's surprising is how few people have actually gone down to Ukraine. They could send a lot more down if they changed the propaganda. The other day, I got quite worried when I saw this little video with Givi that you showed on Radio Free Europe. So this was a video of a sort of a DNR commander humiliating, taunting with a sword some Ukrainian POWs. It was the first time I'd seen sadism being celebrated. Now, that's a very, very, very different mood. That reminds us a lot more of Yugoslavia and Milosevic's propaganda there. So if they let, you know, if they suddenly release this aggression, then things do get much more frightening than they already are. Well, and that's a switch, because it is about keeping people kind of appalled and passive.
Well, there was also, I mean, if you looked at the report, this was cited by BBC Monitoring, but I remember the January 22nd report after the attack on the bus station in Donetsk, where they were showing the Ukrainian POWs being like pelted with by locals and seemed to be taking a lot of pleasure in that. So there is more of this sadism and humiliation going on than there was in the past, no?
Sure, I mean, this worries me, because this is a qualitatively different type of propaganda, because most of it has been, you know, based on being the victim. Was the Givi stuff actually shown on TV, or was that just on internet?
That I don't know, because I, of course, saw it on the internet. But sure. I don't know if it was shown live in the broadcast.
That's it. Yeah, it's still like web. Putin is the man with the doves of peace, and only the nasty Ukrainians and Americans are stopping him bringing the doves of peace.
Right. Now, another thing that jumped out at me in the BBC Monitor report was that people are almost, Russians have been almost traumatized by this barrage, that people are beginning to find it difficult to talk to each other about the Ukraine crisis. They want to change the subject. They cited a post on Facebook in which a man described how he had this nasty argument with his father over events in Ukraine, to the point that he ran out of the house in his stocking feet, caught a taxi home until his father called him and asked him to come back and, you know, asked for his forgiveness. And he said he finally went back and he knew everything was all right when his father had the TV turned off. And you have to wonder how much, and I'd like to hear from both of you about, like, how much of this you've seen in terms of, like, this kind of thing where this, where people are kind of shell-shocked by all of this.
I mean, I've lost several friends who, it's like, I sometimes compare it to a B movie with, like, a zombie movie where, like, people are becoming zombies, and, like, you talk to one of your friends and halfway through the conversation you realize they've got little patriotic propaganda bite marks on their necks, and suddenly they're quoting Prohano. I mean, like, oh my God, my friends have been turned into vampires as well. It's like that. Listen, we use the words trans brainwashing unprofessionally. Actually, these are very, very specific techniques which are not that difficult to do. Every time you watch an advert, you have been brainwashed with it for like a millisecond. Yeah. Imagine this was happening non-stop. Every time you see a magic trick and you think it was real, you've just been brainwashed. These are actually very specific techniques, and they're not very difficult to do. Most TV channels don't do them in the world because they're highly unethical and they'd be regulated very fast.
Right.
But here they're being used non-stop and they're being licensed to. And so we shouldn't be surprised. And it's the same thing when someone gets into a cult, you know. You see perfectly normal people get into cults. Perfectly normal. It's not true that you have to be special. Normal people become Scientologists or Kabbalah cults or whatever. And everyone's like, how the hell did that happen? They've been manipulated. They've been brainwashed. It's a real thing. It's not a science fiction thing.
Right, so they're basically taking things that are, and it's another example of Russia using Western marketing techniques like subliminal advertising or whatever, and using it 24/7. Right? Is that what we're seeing here?
Some of them, yeah. Some of them were developed. A lot of these techniques were actually, I mean, some of the ones that they're really into were actually developed in the U.S. Army to train soldiers, and then were developed as therapy first, sort of hypnotherapeutic techniques in the 60s in California. Then they became part of these fetish cults in California in the 60s and 70s, and Russia is now using them on TV. Right. So, like, talking about NLP, we're talking about the use of various life spring techniques. But you know, the Russians are using a bit of everything. You know, there's some very old school ones they're using as well that the Nazis use.
Well, before we move on to the second half and we'll look a little bit closer at Professor Soloway's lecture, Ben, do you have any last thoughts on this? Have you run into this situation where people are seem almost traumatized by this, by all of this, or how it's affected them?
This is not a Russian phenomenon. So over the last summer, we had a very similar situation developing on Facebook and on Twitter in Britain with people's views on Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza. And I think it's partly a function of people being forced into these confrontations on Facebook and Twitter in a far larger way. That was a very widespread phenomenon in Britain, especially amongst the Jewish community, of feeling a lot of intense hostility from others, a lot of divisions within families about this. And it was a similar situation that played itself out in Israel or in America or elsewhere. So I think what's happening in Russia is part of how wars are experienced in a 21st century where a lot of our existence is now digital, and where Facebook and Twitter encourage us into comments and fights and put downs. I think that's heightening the intensity of it. I think experiences of wars, say in the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia, without the internet there, people were not encouraged to debate the conflict, simply because that wasn't the platform, because television was the only platform, and it was reading a newspaper, and those are purely passive. There was no like, dislike, retweet, comment function there.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and dive deeper into Professor Valery Solovey's lecture on propaganda and its role in psychological and neuro-linguistic programming. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the recently published book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Also joining us via Skype from London is journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell in and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfarl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Is there a way to protect yourself from this? Yes, there is. Don't watch television. This is your main antidote. Television is not for intelligent people. If you want to keep your mind free of this information radiation, you must choose not to watch television.
Well, that, of course, was MGMO Professor Valery Solovey giving a lecture last April, giving his students very valuable advice. Don't watch television. It's not for smart people. If you want to protect yourself from this, what he calls information radiation, stay away from the television set. In the second half, I wanted to dive deeper into his lecture, which is available on YouTube and which everybody interested in Russia should certainly watch. I know I was fascinated by it when it came out, and I was looking for an excuse to use it, which the BBC monitoring report gave me this week. I'd like to get you both to react to that first thing we had there, though. Is television for stupid people? Is that a fair assessment, Peter? You worked in television for most of your career.
Is television for stupid people?
If you want, well, he said television is not for intelligent people. If you want to keep your mind free of this information radiation, you must choose not to watch television.
That's sadly not enough anymore. Firstly, people work as, you know, re-repeaters. They're the best transmitters when you're doing this sort of stuff. So people who watch it will still retransmit stuff. But also the Kremlin has now learned to use the internet very, very effectively and very insidiously. And we're all kind of just working out how good they're getting at it. We thought the internet would be a priori a tool for liberation. It can actually just be, it can be the propagandist's ideal tool, because you can switch off the TV, you can't really switch off your Facebook, and they've learned to sort of put people inside the conversation and spin it in certain ways. I mean, I remember during the Ukraine one, people that I knew who I suspect are doing some work on the side as well, they're sort of out-of-work journalists, were suddenly doing non-stop throwing in photographs of the Volyn massacre during the Second World War, which was, you know, when Ukrainians slaughtered quite a lot of Poles and Jews, non-stop throwing that in, just getting everyone to think about how evil Ukrainians are, how fascist they are, just non-stop photos of this. And this was coming up inside, you know, at 2 a.m. I was just flipping through my Facebook. So you can switch off the TV, but through the internet, you can climb inside people's lives and their conversations so much deeper. So it's actually, you know, you'd have to switch off all electronic equipment, stop talking to anyone, retire far, far, far into the Russian countryside, and just read, you know, just do sort of Buddhist chanting, and then maybe you'll be free of it.
That's an interesting observation, Ben. We've always talked about the divide between television Russia and internet Russia, the former being the retrograde part and the latter being the progressive part.
I don't think that's strictly speaking true anymore. One of the more interesting reports on Russian media behavior I saw in the past 6 months was what websites do Russians actually link to? And there had been a shift over the past few years almost entirely onto state-controlled or state-edited or self-censoring platforms. And the Russians are not getting their news anymore online from independent bloggers or from courageous newspaper outfits. So I think that's a kind of cliche that we should leave in December 2011. The other thing that I read with great interest the other day was by a Klishin, one of the Bolotnaya organizers and one of the journalists that's often now paraded around the world a little bit, is a museum piece for the Bolotnaya movement. And he was talking about how people like him, the free-thinking side of Russian journalism, had been defeated online by troll farms, tens of thousands of people employed by the Kremlin as online commenters to dominate Twitter and Facebook and other platforms. And he was signalling that the internet, from being a place where there were virtually no pro-Putin voices, was now a place where the opposition or free thinkers felt completely outnumbered and harassed, and it was no longer this platform where there was no Putin.
Do you think we'll begin to see the full-on type of propaganda assault we've been seeing on television, on the internet as well? Is that, or is it going to be a different kind of a different kind of a media, a different kind of a different means on the internet?
Well, I think we're looking at a situation now online. It's only happened in the last year or so where every critical or opposition voice is outnumbered 10 or 100 to 1 on Twitter. Uh-huh. Everything the opposition has, the government has replicated, cloned, given more money and more influence to. If you just look at the comments, like comment space on blogs in Russia used to be a space for discussion and organization. Now they're just a space for the Kremlin to scrawl its message 100, 200 or 300 times. Like YouTube videos used to be almost uniquely dominated by the opposition as a way of disseminating their information. Now they're outnumbered by Kremlin clones 10, 100 to 1. Even just popular Twitter accounts, they're very much outnumbered now. And there's a sense of resignation and defeat. And a lot of the key bloggers and Twitter voices have basically been paralyzed, such as Navalny.
All right. Well, I wanted to go into another clip from Professor Solovey's lecture explaining the psychological effect of all that ominous music and disturbing images that we see on Russian TV. We discussed this a little bit in the first half. We can, this will give us a chance to dive back into that again. So let's listen to this clip.
What is the prevailing tone in the coverage of events in Ukraine now? Since November last year, it has been unrest, disturbance, and pogroms. And when did it all begin? Recall the news reports from January, the time of really bloody events. You will recall the rapidly changing images of flames, burning tires, running people, alarming music. During this time, people are immersed in a trance. When we watch rapidly changing images and hear dramatic music, our ability to perceive reality critically begins to diminish.
So yeah, this is again, we discussed this a little bit in the first half. Any more thoughts on this? I mean, this putting people into a trance. The one thing I'm always wondering, especially Ben, as you were just speaking, is if we're going to start seeing this kind of thing, this kind of rapidly moving, disturbing images with ominous music to put people in a trance, to diminish their critical faculties, and be open to suggestion. That's the most important thing, to be, after this happens, to be open to suggestion. If we're going to begin to see this on YouTube or on the internet, or if we're going to see these methods employed in the internet, Peter, what do you think there? Do you think this is the internet?
We already are seeing that on the internet. The internet has become, over the last year, through Twitter, a place to endlessly tweet images of dead children and dead people, to disturb and insert horrific sites of conflict directly into your mobile phone. And the Kremlin has been very, very good at getting its internet people to ceaselessly tweet those pictures of really disturbing images from Donbass to justify their arguments and make their case. Music, the internet is very poor at linking onto news sites, so I don't think we're going to be seeing any of that. But just click on any of the big Kremlin tweeters and you'll see that they are tweeting these pictures 20, 30 times a day.
Right.
We don't know if these pictures actually come from Donbass. A lot of analysis has showed a lot of them actually were pictures from the Chechen conflict that had been redistributed, or from wars in other corners of the world completely.
But the big difference is that when you put this together in a television program, and this is what Sullivan is kind of getting at, is the first thing is you get the viewer into this trance-like state. Peter, I know you think this is nothing, this is nothing special, but I mean, there's a logic to this. You get the viewer in this trance-like state, critical faculties are diminished, open to power of suggestion, and then you get your message through, right? Do you see this replicated online now that the Kremlin seems to be moving into that medium, you know, in a big way?
Yes, ceaselessly retweeting dead children is a known way online to make people agitated, frightened, and upset. Uh-huh. Just take a look at Graham W. Phillips' Twitter account. And he's a sort of, in his own way, quite a fascinating character, this sort of British chap who ended up becoming, by his own volition, one of the Ukrainian rebels' propagandists. So I'm just looking at his account now, and endless pictures of children, either dead or otherwise, or threatened. And he's managed to carve out what appears to be a highly popular Twitter account on a segment of the Russian internet based on these pictures. So, yes. I also, just to come back again to, is this new? I don't think this is new at all. Like, propaganda has always been about emotions. I don't really see anything qualitatively new in Russian propaganda compared to the creepy marches of the 1930s in Turkey or Russia or in Germany. I don't see anything particularly dramatically different from propaganda under the colonels in Greece in the 1980s or the more sinister parts of Soviet propaganda in the 1980s. I think what's different is that Russia has a highly developed and in parts gibberish pseudo-analytical conversation about this. And I think we risk taking that, trying to look for answers in that and taking it seriously when it's not. And I don't know. I'd like to hear Peter's opinion on that.
Yeah, Peter, let's hear your thoughts on that. I'd like to.
Well, I mean, there's two things. I mean, what is new? What's new is that, and this is not just about Russia at all. The Middle East specialist David Patrick Arakos, who's actually now in Ukraine a lot as well, puts this very well. He said, look at the last Israeli-Gaza war. It didn't actually matter who won on the ground. Both sides knew perfectly well how the war would end. It was a pointless war militarily. The only battle that mattered was in terms of narratives. Same with Donbass. I mean, we keep on talking about this. People want a frozen conflict. It doesn't matter. He can have any conflict he wants. What matters is the story he gets to tell. So both the Russians and the Chinese have been elaborating this idea of contactless war. The Chinese call it three-way war and use it very aggressively in their near abroad. So we're now, for the first time, we're seeing a truly sort of postmodern gladiatorial battles of the spectacle where all that matters is the story. All that matters is the story. Putin can tell mainly domestically. Abroad is far less important to him. So it actually really doesn't, almost doesn't matter what happens on the ground. So usually we have seen propaganda and information operations as the beginning of a military operation or the accompaniment to a military operation. Now increasingly they are the operation. Simply because technologically media and information is everywhere and there's so much more of it and it's so much more intense and so much more important. So that's what's changed. Mm-hmm. That's a technological shift, which means we have a slight kind of a shift in the theory of warfare. So that's important.
So I just want to jump in here and talk a little bit about what's actually happening diplomatically at the moment as a way to sort of end the conversation while we still have time. What's happening right now, I think, is quite significant, is that after the Minsk Accords, most Western governments believed that they had more or less frozen the conflict in eastern Ukraine and that there would be some fighting around Donetsk airport. And once that fell, Putin would more or less be satisfied and that would be the full glacialization of the facts on the ground. In fact, the opposite seems to have happened, and after the fall of Donetsk airport, there's been a resurgence of fighting, and pockets have been created, small towns have been surrounded or fallen, and there's been an uptick of shelling and deaths and an increase in refugee flows. From the American perspective, they now have put on the table two nuclear options. I don't mean they put them on the table in terms of actual policy, as in they're going to do it, but they've been discussing this and making sure the Russian government knows they've been discussing it. The first is arming Ukraine and actually giving the Ukrainians lethal aid so that, not that they can reconquer Donetsk, but that they will just kill thousands of rebels and be able to do that very effectively, so that the costs of Putin's war ramp significantly up, and that restores American deterrence somehow by making Putin think that these wars are extremely expensive. The other nuclear option they put on the table is yanking Russia out of the SWIFT global payment system. And if you look at your bank statements, you'll see you've got a SWIFT code. And in the 21st century, any form of sale or transaction requires this internet electronic system. And the West has the capacity to expel Russia from that. And that would mean buying or selling anything from a lemon to a carton of juice or a barrel of oil across borders. Russia would be unable to do it electronically and would have to do it in hard currency and literally passing things over the border or going via very, very shaky and incomplete systems that the Chinese had. And that would be an economic act of war, probably more devastating, actually certainly more devastating than if the Americans physically blew up Moscow City with bombs. Russia's very frightened about either of these two scenarios being played out, and the Europeans are also very frightened about this. The German government is opposed to a proxy war in Ukraine, doesn't want to see America arm the Ukrainian government, doesn't think it has the capacity to stop America doing this unless it can convince Putin to accede to a frozen conflict. And the Americans are currently permitting the Germans, with a little bit of French backup, to go to Moscow and try and persuade Putin into a frozen conflict plan. We don't know what their peace plan is. No details of it have been leaked enough for me to comment on it. Anything at this point will basically constitute a surrender for Ukraine, because these territories politically are never going to return to being governed by Poroshenko, simply because the Ukrainians lost in being unable to retake them in the summer. The question is how bad a surrender is this going to be for Ukraine? There's a debate which I think is quite noxious within Western foreign policy right now, that Ukraine should be able to make its own decisions. And I think that's actually sort of dodging the bullet, really, that if Ukraine wanted to make its own decisions, it shouldn't have ended up 100% financially dependent on Germany and on the IMF. And the West needs to either give Ukraine the armaments to make Putin bleed and to force Putin into concessions on the question in the East, or it needs to tell the Ukrainians that they lost and accept a frozen conflict on Putin's terms. Unfortunately, diplomacy with Russia on this has been incredibly choppy and very bad, because Western diplomats don't really know what conversation they're having with Putin. Various forms of off-ramps, frozen conflicts, face-saving measures have been proposed. America ran its own high-level track through Kissinger to try and persuade the Russians to de-escalate the conflict. The Europeans have been trying, and Putin has just not been responding. So what's happening right now is a good cop, bad cop game, with the hope to make Putin accept a deal that the Germans think is good for him. Otherwise, there's the looming threat of dramatic escalation. What I personally think we should be doing in Western foreign policy is focusing in on two things. Like, the Ukrainians have basically lost, and we need to accept that, and we tell them that. And we should be trying to sweeten the deal for them to accept that they've lost these provinces, and stabilizing the currency or debt relief is a perfect way to do that. But we need to make sure that Putin never attempts another war like this again by making the costs for this as high as possible. I don't think it's the moral thing to do to try and make this military through a proxy war currently, even though we could end up in that stage sooner or later. I just think we should continue to ramp up the economic sanctions on Russia, even if they do accede to a frozen conflict in Ukrainian territory. We shouldn't remove the banking sanctions that have already been put in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, this sounds to me, I mean, that is a very succinct analysis of where we are right now. But Peter, this is more than a war in narratives, no? I mean, from what Ben just outlined there, I mean, we are not just in a movie about Donbass. The war isn't just about the narrative, or is it? Let's see. Peter, what do you have to say about that?
Hold on, the war in Donbass is an accident. No one kind of planned this. This is just a mess that Russia got into. Russia was at war with the West way before Donbass. Russia began the narrative of war with the West after the protests in 2011 by saying everything that Soloveil was talking about was already used way before Donbass, that framing and that agenda setting. The techniques have been they've been using very aggressively 15 years. So Russia was at war with the West on a purely narrative sort of basis ever since 2011, when that was, you know, that was meant to be CIA's fault, and it was Russian civilization against Western civilization. Then Ukraine oddly just stumbled into that through a fluke. I don't think it was planned in any way at all. So I mean, if you look back at the Eurasian thing, that was very much all about narratives. People didn't give a toss about customs union with Kazakhstan. The whole idea was to have a Eurasian Union as to have a narrative battle with the EU, and we'll have this sort of tussle in the space of ideas and all this rubbish. I don't think he expected a real conflict to start and real sanctions. This is all way outside the script that they were writing. The funny thing is, there's a lesson maybe deeply to learn here, that when one plays with narratives, they end up bursting into real life at some point. Maybe there's an interesting logic there, but no one, I mean, Donetsk is a mess. No one planned it. Since then, Putin's been improvising. But I hope Ben is right. I'm not sure Putin wants a frozen conflict.
I don't think he does.
Putin wants to mess up Ukraine permanently, and frozen conflict actually gives Ukraine the chance to regroup. Actually, I think a lot of people in Kiev do want to lose those territories. They just have to do it with honor. They can't do it dishonorably. Yeah. That's the trick that the Ukrainians are trying to pull off. They want to lose it the right way and then not pay for them. I don't think Putin wants any... I fear he doesn't want to frozen conflict. He wants something open-ended, murky, on top of which he can build any narrative he needs that day.
Right. But
in which case, I think the position of Western foreign policy needs to be that if you want that, it's going to be extremely expensive, economically.
They have
to
pay for it or what?
I'm sorry?
Ukrainians need to lose with honour. I'm speculating. I'm trying to imagine I'm Poroshenko, thinking very cynically. I would want to lose those territories with honour... and not pay for them. Those are two things I've got to achieve. They can't afford to pay for them, literally.
Right.
I mean, the Western foreign policy goal needs to be to make any of these, to make this war so expensive in economic terms for Russian banks that they will be opposed to attempting the experiment again in a few years' time when Russia's really in a dark place economically, or Putin's ratings collapse again, or they lose the narrative again in Ukraine or Belarus or elsewhere or in southern Ukraine.
I agree. My sense about sanctions is that they're not... We always talk about sanctions like they're meant to affect Russia now. My idea of sanctions is that they're preventative for the future and for other people.
We know that Putin had a meeting in the Kremlin before he moved into annexed Crimea, in which he asked the Kremlin top brass, can we afford this? And they went, yes, we can afford this. We need to make sure that if Putin ever calls them in again before doing something dramatic in foreign policy, that they will go to him, no, we can't do this. This will break the regime or break our sediment of support. Now coming on to what I think is going to happen next and what that means for propaganda and the national narrative, Russia's going to have a really bad recession. It's going to be really difficult. They're going to have to sack a lot of people. There's some speculation that a million and a half people might have to be laid off. There are going to be big contractions in state employment, in state subsidy, in state funding. A lot of banks over the next year are slowly going to have to become propped up by the state in very murky schemes. Russia's heading into a massive credit crunch, and a lot of people are going to start losing a lot of money. And I think that the deeper the economic crisis goes, the more of a ramp up into the propaganda of aggression versus the propaganda of Russia being the victim we're going to see. And I think as the deeper the economic crisis goes, and we're also going to see a shift in gear and an uptick in the war on the internet. And I anticipate that definitely over the next 18 months that the forces currently pushing to unplug Russia from the internet as we know it, such as Tor, Facebook, Twitter, will probably gain the upper hand in the Kremlin. So that would be my world in 2016 prediction if I was ever invited to write something like that.
There's also a question of technology. Several people have pointed this out, including Vasily Gartov, who used to be at RIA Novosti and now is in sort of self-imposed exile in Boston. The television is technologically what Marshall McLuhan, the great sort of philosopher and shaman of media, called a cold medium. So basically, putting it in human language, you watch TV on the couch drinking beer. It is, we've had fairly peaceful 50 years because TV has been the main kind of force of propaganda. It's naturally a passive maker. Internet is what McLuhan would call the hot medium, as in, like, it's all about interaction. It's all about sort of, like, getting involved and getting out there.
Yes, sometimes that's a big shift.
Online, but a lot of the time, it means you then go out in the streets. So it's no coincidence that since the internet's appeared, you've got ISIS, the Arab Spring, the Russian protests, both ways. It can be positive or negative, but it's all about action. It's all about agitation. So as we move into an online world, I think and I fear we will see much more conflict, especially that kind of low-level kind of area, as in not mass movements of tanks, but people fighting each other in insurrections, revolutions, and small but very violent conflicts. So the internet by itself is proving to be a very, very dangerous medium when it comes to aggression and action. And
it's just to jump in on that, I think it's very interesting to look back at events in the last 20 years and imagine how they would have been different if we had had the current social media set up. So what would 9/11 have been like and the response to 9/11 have been like in the US if you'd had Twitter? Would that upsurge of anti-Muslim rage have created its own hashtag and forced politicians into a certain position? What would the hashtag of 9/11 be? Would it have been "Let's Roll," like from, I believe it was the fourth plane? Yes. Would, looking at France, looking at the Je suis Charlie hashtag and how that defined and forced politicians into reacting to that. And it's a very uncomfortable slogan, and it's one that they certainly wouldn't have cooked up or dreamt up themselves. I think that's very interesting, and I think that's we're going to see that being the future in politics to a certain extent, because the one thing social media has done is it's partially broken the monopoly of publishers, and we've now got this space where mass movements can flash up and vanish very quickly. So I think that leads to a much more chaotic situation.
Bringing this back, and I've been fascinated listening to you two on all of this. Ben, you paint a couple of possible scenarios here where this can go. Russia doesn't want to freeze this conflict. I agree. Or I would say they want to freeze it in a way that suits them. They want to freeze it Bosnia style. They don't want to freeze it Georgia style. You know, Georgia style allowed the rest of Georgia to basically consolidate its political system. Bosnia, you have a dysfunctional government that can't do anything, which is what Russia wants in Ukraine. So there's two scenarios of how this conflict is eventually going to get frozen. Either Russia gets its way in a Bosnia scenario, or it doesn't get its way in a Georgia-style scenario. Peter, I wanted to ask you to take those two possibilities, just before we wrap up, we just got a little bit of time, and paint what kind of narrative could Russia build on each of those scenarios, bearing in mind that, as Ben points out, we're headed for some very, very rough economic times in Russia. Can you see which narrative they could build on either of those outcomes?
Why doesn't Ben go first? He's much better on Yugoslavia. I want to see what he says.
Well, not so much on Yugoslavia, but on if Ukraine turns into a Bosnia-style variant, i.e. federalization as Russia describes it.
Bosnia is an EU protectorate, and the EU pays for everything, and the EU makes sure that this political stagnation is just sort of miserable and not deadly. So
Russia and Serbia have free reign in the RS, though.
No, they don't. I think that there's much more... I don't think that's exactly the case in Bosnia. Situation in Ukraine, if Putin gets away, will be far more dangerous than Bosnia, because Russia will continue to attack and undermine the banking system. That doesn't happen in Bosnia because the European Union guarantees the banking system. You'll see Russia paying for political parties, creating false flag events, operating freely all across the rump Ukraine with its security forces. It's a far more dangerous situation than in Bosnia. And broadly in Bosnia, even though you do have a lot of dysfunction on big reforms, low-level reforms such as schools, roads, basic industry, resolving right of return for refugees, that's more or less happened. It's like, it's not a uniquely dark scenario in Bosnia.
But you've got a dysfunctional government, basically.
You've got a dysfunctional government, but you've got a dysfunctional central government that does not very much. Mm. And in all across Bosnia, you do have serious, ongoing, Western-funded, local-led projects to improve living standards. And what Putin wants is a Ukraine where that can't happen, where Ukraine is forced into a failed state scenario like Georgia in the 1990s.
Right. And if we get the Georgia scenario, basically, where this conflict is frozen, but it's contained to Donbass, however defined, wherever the lines are.
One of the rumors that the German-French plan being presented in Moscow contains is some sort of UN peacekeeping force that would delimit the Donbass area.
Right.
So that would appear to be that the West is definitely pushing for that way of closing the conflict. I don't think the Russian position on what it wants for Ukraine has actually ever changed since the Russian Foreign Ministry published this non-paper that circulated around online and circulated around various foreign ministries just after the revolution. It was that they want a Ukraine which is never going to be part of the EU, which is never going to be part of NATO, which accepts the loss of Crimea, and that their boys rule in a so-called federal scenario in as much of the south and the east as they can grab. And their men sit in Kiev and can veto big foreign policy decisions. That's far, 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 far more than a Bosnia scenario, which is what the Russians are calling it because it's loosely inspired by the Dayton Agreement.
Right. But the other variant is where they don't have the ability to influence Kiev, that the Donbass is kind of it's similar to Abkhazia or South Ossetia in that sense, where it's de jure part of the country, but de facto not. And the rest of the country can move forward.
Well, that's the possibility where the West could, if I was advising the governments that matter on this, one option is for the West just to tell the Ukrainians to cut their losses. It's better to lose these two provinces completely than to have Putin's men in Kiev. And if the Ukrainians, if Putin can't accept a Georgia-style scenario, a way should be devised so that Ukraine can extricate itself from this territory that Putin's created. There's no point for, if Ukraine is interested in a future of reform and of development and trying to create fulfilling lives of its citizens, in trapping itself in a pointless negotiation platform or national integrity that will only help Russia.
Peter, last thoughts from you before we wrap it up.
Sure, look, I don't know about all this sort of like international relations stuff. Oops, sorry. I don't know about any international relations because I don't understand any of that.
Construct a narrative for us.
About stories. So it's very, look, Putin needs several stories. The first story, most important, doesn't matter when Russia self-destructs. All that matters is that Ukraine is destroyed first. And he will probably achieve that. And he's pretty sure that he can achieve that. He doesn't care about Russia going into recession. He just wants the Kremlin to kind of like destroy itself. So that's story number one. Ukraine is buggered. The revolution led to chaos. Don't think about that as revolution is anything good. That's story four. I mean, that's making up for the mess of the Maidan. That's kind of a story he had to invent very fast because he messed up the Maidan so bad. Story number two, which is one that he's been cooking up for a while, is Russia is a great power. Russia versus the West. A Yalta-like moment. You know, it doesn't matter that it's really like Yalta. It doesn't look like Yalta. And the simulacra of drawing dividing lines and endless conflicts with the West. Ideally, there would be no real conflict with the West, and he'd be able to sort of do all the usual kind of like money laundering and stuff. So that's his ideal thing. The reality can be whatever, anything really. He does need a big battle with the West. That's the number one ideology and storytelling in the country. And he needs the story of Ukraine on its knees and destroyed. So the reality that's on the ground can be anything. It can be Daytona 500. It doesn't matter. All that matters, he can tell those stories.
So you think he can build those two narratives regardless?
No, not regardless. Because obviously you can't. He can do a hell of a lot regardless. We've seen that. I mean, he's invented fascists in Kiev. But no, he has to keep reality open-ended enough to be able to tell that story.
But Peter, in Moscow, there's hardware to this software.
Yes, that's what I mean. There is some. I agree. But I think the trick is keeping the hardware as open as you can.
Making the GRUs become more important in Putin's decision making. The special forces have become more important in the circle. And these people have been coming in and out of the Kremlin with increasing frequency. And they're there, and Putin's talking to them and asking their opinion. And these people want facts on the ground. These people are different in mentality to the political technologists. And they're trying to build Russian power in Donbass. And they want to secure these roads open to Odessa in the long run. And they want to make sure that the road to Kharkiv remains open. And they want troops and bases and political control over this territory. And these people don't make the decision, but I think that they're in the room.
Yeah, I mean, they're there in the room, but I think the GRU is wonderfully flexible. I think that, you know, they understand the idea of psyops and telling stories as well as Putin does. But of course, there's a hardware attached to it. Even though he's shown many times that he doesn't need a reality on the ground, he just makes it up. But of course it is. But these guys think very flexibly as well. They don't. You know, I think they don't think like meat, like the foreign ministry, which wants agreements and data. They think very much in terms of politics being a psychological operation, which is what this is all about.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up. We're just about out of time. And I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been Peter Pomerantsev, author of the recently published book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. Also joining us via Skype from London has been journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thanks for the enlightening discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave with you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.